Introduction. Preventing, arresting, and reversing are leading killers. There may be no such thing as dying from old age. From a study of more than 42,000 consecutive autopsies, centenarians, those who live past 100, were found to have succumbed to diseases in 100% of the cases examined, though most were perceived even by their physicians to have been healthy just prior to death. Not one died of old age. Until recently, advanced age had been considered to be a disease itself, but people don't die as a consequence of maturing. They die from disease, most commonly heart attacks. Most deaths in the United States are preventable, and they are related to what we eat. Our diet is the number one cause of premature death and the number one cause of disability. Surely diet must also be the number one thing taught in medical schools, right? Sadly, it's not. According to the most recent national survey, only a quarter of medical schools offer a single course in nutrition, down from 37% 30 years ago. While most of the public evidently considers doctors to be very credible sources of nutrition information, 6 out of 7 graduating doctors surveyed felt physicians were inadequately trained to counsel patients about their diets. One study found that people off the street sometimes know more about basic nutrition than their doctors, concluding, quote, "Physicians should be more knowledgeable about nutrition than their patients, but these results suggest that this is not necessarily true," unquote. To remedy this situation, a bill was introduced into the California State Legislature to mandate physicians get at least 12 hours of nutrition training anytime over the next 4 years. It might surprise you to learn that the California Medical Association came out strongly opposed to the bill, as did other mainstream medical groups, including the California Academy of Family Physicians. The bill was amended from a mandatory minimum of 12 hours over 4 years down to 7 hours, and then doctored, one might say, down to zero. The California Medical Board does have one subject requirement, 12 hours on pain management and end-of-life care for the terminally ill. This disparity between prevention and mere mitigation of suffering could be a metaphor for modern medicine. A doctor a day may keep the apples away. Back in 1903, Thomas Edison predicted that the, quote, "doctor of the future will give no medicine, but will instruct his patient in the care of the human frame and diet, and in the cause and prevention of diseases," unquote. Sadly, all it takes is a few minutes watching pharmaceutical ads on television imploring viewers to, quote, "ask your doctor," unquote, about this or that drug to know that Edison's prediction hasn't come true. A study of thousands of patient visits found that the average length of time primary care doctors spend talking about nutrition is about 10 seconds. But hey, this is the 21st century. Can't we eat whatever we want and simply take meds when we begin having health problems? For too many patients, and even my physician colleagues, this seems to be the prevailing mindset. Global spending for prescription drugs is surpassing $1 trillion annually, with the United States accounting for about one-third of this global market. Why do we spend so much on pills? Many people assume that our manner of death is pre-programmed into our genes. High blood pressure by 55, heart attacks by 60, maybe cancer at 70, and so on. But for most of the leading causes of death, the science shows that our genes often account for only 10 to 20% of risk at most. For instance, as you'll hear in this audiobook, the rates of killers like heart disease and major cancers differ up to 100-fold among various populations around the globe. When people move from low to high-risk countries, their disease rates almost always change to those of the new environment. New diet, new diseases. So, while a 60-year-old American man living in San Francisco has about a 5% chance of having a heart attack within 5 years, should he move to Japan and start eating and living like the Japanese, his 5-year risk would drop to only 1%. Japanese Americans in their 40s can have the same heart attack risk as Japanese in their 60s. Switching to an American lifestyle, in effect aged their hearts a full 20 years. The Mayo Clinic estimates that nearly 70% of Americans take at least one prescription drug. Yet despite the fact that more people in this country are on medications that aren't, not to mention the steady influx of ever newer and more expensive drugs on the market, we aren't living much longer than others. In terms of life expectancy, the United States is down around 27 or 28 out of the 34 top free market democracies. People in Slovenia live longer than we do. And the extra years we're living aren't necessarily healthy or vibrant. Back in 2011, a disturbing analysis of mortality and morbidity was published in the Journal of Gerontology. Are Americans living longer now compared to about a generation ago? Yes, technically. But are those extra years necessarily healthy ones? No. And it's worse than that. We're actually living fewer healthy years now than we once did. Here's what I mean. A 20-year-old in 1998 could expect to live about 58 more years, while a 20-year-old in 2006 could look forward to 59 more years. However, the 20-year-old from the 1990s might live 10 of those years with chronic disease, whereas now it's more like 13 years, with heart disease, cancer, diabetes, or a stroke. So it feels like one step forward, three steps back. The researchers also noted we're living two fewer functional years. That is, for 2 years we're no longer able to perform basic life activities, such as walking a quarter of a mile, standing or sitting for 2 hours without having to lie down, or being able to stand without special equipment. In other words, we're living longer, but we're living sicker. With these rising disease rates, our children may even die sooner. A special report published in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled, quote, "A Potential Decline in Life Expectancy in the United States in the 21st Century," unquote, concluded that, quote, "The steady rise in life expectancy observed in the modern era may soon come to an end, and the youth of today may, on average, live less healthy and possibly even shorter lives than their parents," unquote. In public health school, students learn there are three levels of preventive medicine. The first is primary prevention, as in trying to prevent people at risk for heart disease from suffering their first heart attack. An example of this level of preventive medicine would be your doctor prescribing you a statin drug for high cholesterol. Secondary prevention takes place when you already have the disease and are trying to prevent it from becoming worse, like having a second heart attack. To do this, your doctor may add an aspirin or other drugs to your regimen. At the third level of preventive medicine, the focus is on helping people manage long-term health problems. So your doctor, for example, might prescribe a cardiac rehabilitation program that aims to prevent further physical deterioration and pain. In 2000, a fourth level was proposed. What could this new quaternary prevention be? Reduce the complications from all the drugs and surgery from the first three levels. But people seem to forget about a fifth concept called primordial prevention that was first introduced by the World Health Organization back in 1978. Decades later, it's finally being embraced by the American Heart Association. Primordial prevention was conceived as a strategy to prevent whole societies from experiencing epidemics of chronic disease risk factors. This means not just preventing chronic disease, but preventing the risk factors that lead to chronic disease. For example, instead of trying to prevent someone with high cholesterol from suffering a heart attack, why not prevent him or her from getting high cholesterol, which leads to the heart attack, in the first place? With this in mind, the American Heart Association came up with the simple seven factors that can lead to a healthier life: not smoking, not being overweight, being quote-unquote very active, defined as the equivalent of walking at least 22 minutes a day, eating healthier, for example, lots of fruits and vegetables, having below-average cholesterol, having normal blood pressure, and having normal blood sugar levels. The American Heart Association's goal is to reduce heart disease deaths by 20% by 2020. If more than 90% of heart attacks may be avoided with lifestyle changes, why so modest an aim? Even 25% was deemed, quote-unquote, unrealistic. The AHA's pessimism may have something to do with the frightening reality of the average American diet. An analysis of the health behaviors of 35,000 adults across the United States was published in the American Heart Association Journal. Most of the participants didn't smoke, about half reached their weekly exercise goals, and about a third of the population got a pass in each of the other categories, except diet. Their diets were scored on a scale from 0 to 5 to see if they met a bare minimum of healthy eating behaviors, such as meeting recommended targets for fruit, vegetable, and whole grain consumption, or drinking fewer than 3 cans of soda a week. How many even reached 4 out of 5 on their healthy eating score? About 1%. Maybe if the American Heart Association achieves its goal of quote-unquote aggressive 20% improvement by 2020, we'll get up to 1.2%. Medical anthropologists have identified several major eras of human disease, starting with the age of pestilence and famine, which largely ended with the Industrial Revolution, or the stage we're in now, the age of degenerative and man-made diseases. This shift is reflected in the changing causes of death over the last century. In 1900, in the United States, the top 3 killers were infectious diseases, pneumonia, tuberculosis, and diarrheal disease. Now, the killers are largely lifestyle diseases, heart disease, cancer, and chronic lung disease. Is this simply because antibiotics have enabled us to live long enough to suffer from degenerative diseases? No. The emergence of these epidemics of chronic disease was accompanied by dramatic shifts in dietary patterns. This is best exemplified by what's been happening to disease rates among people in the developing world over the last few decades as they've rapidly westernized their diets. In 1990, around the world, most years of healthy life were lost to undernutrition, such as diarrheal diseases in malnourished children, but now the greatest disease burden is attributed to high blood pressure, a disease of overnutrition. The pandemic of chronic disease has been ascribed in part to the near-universal shift towards a diet dominated by animal-sourced and processed foods, in other words, more meat, dairy, eggs, oils, soda, sugar, and refined grains. China is perhaps the best-studied example. There, a transition away from the country's traditional plant-based diet was accompanied by a sharp rise in diet-related chronic diseases such as obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, and cancer. Why do we suspect these changes in diet and disease are related? After all, rapidly industrializing societies undergo multitudes of changes. How are scientists able to parse out the effects of specific foods? To isolate the effects of different dietary components, researchers can follow the diets and diseases of large groups of defined individuals over time. Take meat, for example. To see what effect an increase in meat consumption might have on disease rates, researchers studied lapsed vegetarians, people who once ate vegetarian diets but then started to eat meat at least once a week, experienced a 146% increase in the odds of heart disease, 152% increase in stroke, 166% increase in diabetes, and a 231% increase in odds for weight gain. During the 12 years after the transition from vegetarian to omnivore, meat eating was associated with a 3.6-year decrease in life expectancy. Even vegetarians can suffer high rates of chronic disease, though, if they eat a lot of processed foods. Take India, for example. This country's rates of diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and stroke have increased far faster than might have been expected given the relatively small increase in per capita meat consumption. This has been blamed on the decreasing, quote, whole plant food content of their diet, unquote, including a shift from brown rice to white and substitution of other refined carbohydrates, packaged snacks, and fast food products for India's traditional staples of lentils, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and seeds. In general, the dividing line between health-promoting and disease-promoting foods may be less plant versus animal-sourced foods and more whole plant foods versus most everything else. To this end, a dietary quality index was developed that simply reflects the percentage of calories people derive from nutrient-rich, unprocessed plant foods on a scale from 0 to 100. The higher people score, the more body fat they may lose over time, and the lower their risk may be of abdominal obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high triglycerides. Studies have shown all these. Comparing the diets of 100 women with breast cancer to 175 healthy women, researchers concluded that scoring higher on the whole food plant diet index, greater than 30 compared to less than 18, may reduce the odds of breast cancer more than 90%. Sadly, most Americans hardly make it past a score of 10. The standard American diet rates 11 out of 100. According to estimates from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 32% of our calories comes from animal foods, 57% comes from processed plant foods, and only 11% comes from whole grains, beans, fruits, vegetables, and nuts. That means on a scale of 1 to 10, the American diet would rate about a 1. We eat almost as if the future doesn't matter. And indeed, there's actually data to back that up. A study entitled Death Row Nutrition, Curious Conclusions of Last Meals, analyzed the last meal requests of hundreds of individuals executed in the United States during a 5-year period. It turns out that the nutritional content didn't differ much from what Americans normally eat. If we continue to eat as though we're having our last meals, eventually they will be. What percentage of Americans hit all of the American Heart Association's Simple 7 recommendations? Of 1,933 men and women surveyed, most met 2 or 3, but hardly any managed to meet all 7 simple health components. In fact, just a single individual could boast hitting all 7 recommendations, one person out of nearly 2,000. As a recent past president of the American Heart Association responded, quote, "That should give all of us pause," unquote. The truth is that adhering to just 4 simple healthy lifestyle factors can have a strong impact on the prevention of chronic diseases. Not smoking, not being obese, getting a half hour of exercise a day, and eating healthier, defined as consuming more fruits, veggies, and whole grains, and less meat. Those 4 factors alone were found to account for 78% of chronic disease risk. If you start from scratch and manage to tick off all 4, you may be able to wipe out more than 90% of your risk of developing diabetes, more than 80% of your risk of having a heart attack, cut by half your risk of having a stroke, and reduce your overall cancer risk by more than 1/3. For some cancers, like our number 2 cancer killer, colon cancer, up to 71% of cases appear to be preventable through a similar portfolio of simple diet and lifestyle changes. Maybe it's time we stop blaming genetics and focus on the more than 70% that is directly under our control. We have the power. Does all this healthy living translate into a longer life as well? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, followed approximately 8,000 Americans aged 20 years or older for about 6 years. They found that 3 cardinal lifestyle behaviors exerted an enormous impact on mortality. People can substantially reduce their risk for early death by not smoking, consuming a healthier diet, and engaging in sufficient physical activity. And the CDC's definitions were pretty laid back. By not smoking, the CDC just meant not currently smoking. And a healthy diet was defined merely as being in the top 40% in terms of complying with the wimpy federal dietary guidelines. And physically active meant averaging about 21 minutes or more a day of at least moderate exercise. People who managed at least 1 of the 3 had a 40% lower risk of dying within a 6-year period. Those who hit 2 out of 3 cut their chances of dying by more than half, and those who scored all 3 behaviors reduced their chances of dying in that time by 82%. Of course, people sometimes fib about how well they eat. How accurate can these findings really be if they're based on people's self-reporting? A similar study on health behaviors and survival didn't just take people's own word for how healthy they were eating. The researchers measured how much vitamin C participants had in their bloodstreams. The level of vitamin C in the blood was considered a good biomarker of plant food intake, and hence was used as a proxy for a healthy diet. The conclusions held up. The drop in mortality risk among those with healthier habits was equivalent to being 14 years younger. It's like turning back the clock 14 years, not with a drug or a DeLorean, but just by eating and living healthier. Let's talk a little more about aging. In each of your cells, you have 46 strands of DNA coiled into chromosomes. At the tip of each chromosome, there's a tiny cap called a telomere, which keeps your DNA from unraveling and fraying. Think of it as the plastic tips at the end of your shoelaces. Every time your cells divide, however, a bit of that cap is lost. And when the telomere is completely gone, your cells can die. Though this is an oversimplification, telomeres have been thought of as your life fuse. They can start shortening as soon as you're born, and when they're gone, you're gone. In fact, forensic scientists can take DNA from a blood stain and roughly estimate how old the person was based on how long their telomeres are. Sounds like fodder for a great scene in CSI, but is there anything you can do to slow down the rate at which your fuses burn? The thought is that if you can slow down this ticking cellular clock, you may be able to slow down the aging process and live longer. So what would you have to do if you wanted to prevent this telomere cap from burning away? Well, smoking cigarettes is associated with triple the rate of telomere loss, so the first step is simple: stop smoking. But the food you eat every day may also have an impact on how fast you lose your telomeres. The consumption of fruits, vegetables, and other antioxidant-rich foods has been associated with longer protective telomeres. In contrast, the consumption of refined grains, soda, meat, including fish, and dairy, has been linked to shortened telomeres. What if you ate a diet composed of whole plant foods and stay away from processed foods and animal foods? Could cellular aging be slowed? The answer lies in an enzyme found in Methuselah. That's the name given to a bristlecone pine tree growing in the White Mountains of California, which, at the time, happened to be the oldest recorded living being and is now nearing its 4,800th birthday. It was already hundreds of years old before the construction of the pyramids in Egypt began. There's an enzyme in the roots of bristlecone pines that appears to peak a few thousand years into their lifespan, and it actually rebuilds telomeres. Scientists called it telomerase. Once they knew what to look for, researchers discovered the enzyme was present in human cells too. The question then became, how can we boost the activity of this age-defying enzyme? Seeking answers, the pioneering researcher Dr. Dean Ornish teamed up with Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who was awarded the 2009 Nobel Prize in Medicine for her discovery of telomerase. In a study funded in part by the U.S. Department of Defense, they found that 3 months of whole food, plant-based nutrition, and other healthy changes could significantly boost telomerase activity, the only intervention ever shown to do so. The study was published in one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. The accompanying editorial concluded that this landmark study, quote, should encourage people to adopt a healthy lifestyle in order to avoid or combat cancer and age-related diseases. So were Dr. Ornish and Dr. Blackburn able to successfully slow down aging with a healthy diet and lifestyle? A 5-year follow-up study was recently published in which the lengths of the study subjects' telomeres were measured. In the control group, the group of participants who did not change their lifestyles, their telomeres predictably shrank with age. But for the healthy living group, not only did their telomeres shrink less, they grew. 5 years later, their telomeres were even longer on average than when they started, suggesting a healthy lifestyle can boost telomerase enzyme activity and reverse cellular aging. Subsequent research has shown that the telomere lengthening wasn't because the healthy lifestyle group was exercising more or losing weight. Weight loss through calorie restriction and an even more vigorous exercise program failed to improve telomere length. So it appears that the active ingredient is the quality, not quantity, of the food eaten. As long as people were eating the same diet, it didn't appear to matter how small their portions were, how much weight they lost, or even how hard they exercised. After a year, they saw no benefit. In contrast, individuals on the plant-based diet exercised only half as much, enjoyed the same amount of weight loss after just 3 months, and achieved significant telomere protection. In other words, it wasn't the weight loss and it wasn't the exercise that reversed cell aging. It was the food. Some people have expressed concern that boosting telomerase activity could theoretically increase cancer risk, since tumors have been known to hijack the telomerase enzyme and use it to ensure their own immortality. But as we'll hear in Chapter 13, Dr. Ornish and his colleagues have used the same diet and lifestyle changes to halt and apparently reverse the progression of cancer in certain circumstances. We'll also hear how the same diet can reverse heart disease, too. What about our other leading killers? It turns out a more plant-based diet may help prevent, treat, and reverse every single one of our 15 leading causes of death. In this audiobook, I'll go through this list with a chapter on each. So here's a list of the leading causes of mortality in the United States. Number one is coronary heart disease, causing 375,000 annual deaths. Number two, lung diseases like lung cancer, COPD, and asthma, 296,000 deaths a year. Killer number three, wiping out 225,000 Americans every year, you'll be surprised, but it'll have to wait until Chapter 15. Number four, leading killer, brain diseases, stroke, Alzheimer's, 214,000 deaths. Number five, digestive cancers, colorectal, pancreatic, and esophageal cancer, 106,000. Number six, infections, respiratory and blood infections, 95,000 deaths. Number seventh leading killer is diabetes, killing 76,000 Americans a year. Number eight, high blood pressure, 65,000. Number nine, liver disease, like cirrhosis and liver cancer, 60,000. Number 10, blood cancers, leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, 56,000 dead. 11, kidney disease, 47,000 dead. Number 12, breast cancer, killing 41,000 people a year in the United States. Number 13, suicide, killing also 41,000 approximately. Number 14, prostate cancer, 28,000 deaths. And finally, the 15th leading cause of death in the United States, Parkinson's disease, killing 25,000 a year. Certainly, there are prescription medications that can help with some of these conditions. For example, you can take statin drugs for your cholesterol to lower risk of heart attacks, pop different pills and inject insulin for diabetes, and take a slew of diuretics and other blood pressure medications for hypertension. But there's only one unifying diet that may help prevent, arrest, or even reverse each of these killers. Unlike with medications, there isn't one kind of diet for optimal liver function and a different diet to improve our kidneys. A heart-healthy diet is a brain-healthy diet, is a lung-healthy diet. The same diet that helps prevent cancer just so happens to be the same diet that may help prevent type 2 diabetes and every other cause of death on the top 15 list. Unlike drugs, which only target specific functions, can have dangerous side effects, and may only treat the symptoms of disease, a healthy diet can benefit all organ systems at once, has good side effects, and may treat the underlying cause of illness. That one unifying diet found to best prevent and treat many of these chronic diseases is a whole food, plant-based diet, defined as an eating pattern that encourages the consumption of unrefined plant foods and discourages meat, dairy products, eggs, and processed foods. In this audiobook, I don't advocate for a vegetarian diet or a vegan diet. I advocate for an evidence-based diet, and the best available balance of science suggests that the more whole plant foods we eat, the better, both to reap their nutritional benefits and to displace less healthful options. Most doctor visits are for lifestyle-based diseases, which means they're preventable diseases. As physicians, my colleagues and I were trained not to treat the root cause, but rather the consequences by giving a lifetime's worth of medications to treat risk factors like high blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol. This approach has been compared to mopping up the floor around an overflowing sink instead of just simply turning off the faucet. Drug companies are more than happy to sell you a new roll of paper towels every day for the rest of your life while the water continues to gush. As Dr. Walter Willett, the chair of nutrition at Harvard University School of Public Health, put it, quote, "The inherent problem is that most pharmacologic strategies do not address the underlying causes of ill health in Western countries, which are not drug deficiencies, unquote. Treating the cause is not only safer and cheaper, but it can work better. So why don't more of my medical colleagues do it? Not only were they not trained how, doctors don't get paid for it. No one profits from lifestyle medicine, other than the patient, so it's not a major part of medical training or practice. That's just how the system works currently. The medical system is set up to financially reward prescribing pills and procedures, not produce. After Dr. Ornish proved that heart disease could be reversed without drugs or surgery, he thought that his studies would have a meaningful effect on the practice of mainstream medicine. After all, he effectively found a cure for our number one killer. But he was mistaken, not about his critically important findings regarding diet and disease reversal, but about how much influence the business of medicine has on the practice of medicine. In his words, Dr. Ornish, quote, realized reimbursement is a more powerful determinant of medical practice than research, unquote. Though there are vested interests, such as processed food and pharmaceutical industries, which fight hard to maintain the status quo, there is one corporate sector that actually benefits from keeping people healthy, namely the insurance industry. Kaiser Permanente, the largest managed care organization in the country, published a nutritional update for physicians in their official medical journal, informing their nearly 15,000 physicians that healthy eating may be, quote, best achieved with a plant-based diet, which we define as a regimen that encourages whole plant-based foods and discourages meats, dairy products, and eggs, as well as all refined and processed foods, unquote. Quote, too often, physicians ignore the potential benefits of good nutrition and quickly prescribe medications instead of giving patients a chance to correct their disease through healthy eating and active living. Physicians should consider recommending a plant-based diet to all their patients, especially those with high blood pressure, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or obesity, unquote. Physicians should give their patients a chance to first correct their disease themselves with plant-based nutrition. The major downside Kaiser Permanente's nutritional update describes is that this diet may work a little too well. If people begin eating plant-based diets while still taking medications, their blood pressure or blood sugar could actually drop so low that their physicians may need to adjust medications or eliminate them altogether. Ironically, the side effect of the diet may be not having to take drugs anymore. The article ends with a familiar refrain, further research is needed. In this case, though, quoting from the article, quote, further research is needed to find ways to make plant-based diets the new normal, unquote. We're a long way off from Thomas Edison's 1903 prediction, but it is my hope that this audiobook will help you understand that most of our leading causes of death and disability are more preventable than inevitable. The primary reason diseases tend to run in families may be that diets tend to run in families. For most of our leading killers, non-genetic factors like diet can account for at least 80 or 90% of cases. As I noted before, this is based on the fact that the rates of cardiovascular disease and major cancers differ fivefold to 100-fold around the world. Migration studies show this is not just genetics. When people move from low-risk to high-risk areas, their disease risk nearly always shoots up to match the new setting. As well, dramatic changes in disease rates within a single generation highlight the primacy of external factors. Colon cancer mortality in Japan in the 1950s was less than one-fifth that of the United States, including Americans of Japanese ancestry. But now, colon cancer rates in Japan are as bad as they are in the United States, a rise that has been attributed in part to the fivefold increase in meat consumption. Research has shown us that identical twins separated at birth will get different diseases based on how they live their lives. A recent American Heart Association-funded study compared the lifestyles and arteries of nearly 500 twins. It found that diet and lifestyle factors clearly trumped genes. You share 50% of your genes with each of your parents, so if one parent dies of a heart attack, you know you've inherited some of that susceptibility. But even among identical twins who have the exact same genes, One could die early of a heart attack, and the other could live a long, healthy life with clean arteries, depending on what she ate and how she lived. Even if both your parents died with heart disease, you should be able to eat your way to a healthy heart. Your family history does not have to become your personal destiny. Just because you're born with bad genes doesn't mean you can't effectively turn them off. As you'll hear in the breast cancer and Alzheimer's disease chapters, even if you're born with high-risk genes, you have tremendous control over your medical destiny. Epigenetics is the hot new field of study that deals with this control of gene activity. Skin cells look and function a lot differently than bone cells, brain cells, or heart cells, but each of our cells has the same complement of DNA. What makes them act differently is that they each have different genes turned on or off. That's the power of epigenetics. Same DNA, but different results. Let me give you an example of how striking this effect can be. Consider the humble honeybee. Queen bees and worker bees are genetically identical, yet queen bees lay up to 2,000 eggs a day, while worker bees are functionally sterile. Queens live up to 3 years, workers may only live 3 weeks. The difference between the two is diet. When the hive's queen is dying, a larva is picked by nurse bees to be fed a secreted substance called royal jelly. When the larva eats this jelly, the enzyme that had been silencing the expression of royal genes is turned off, and a new queen is born. The queen has the exact same genes as any of the workers, but because of what she ate, different genes are expressed, and her life and lifespan are dramatically altered as a result. Cancer cells can use epigenetics against us by silencing tumor suppressor genes that could otherwise stop the cancer in its tracks. So even if you're born with good genes, cancer can sometimes find a way to turn them off. A number of chemotherapy drugs have been developed to restore our body's natural defenses, but their use has been limited due to their high toxicity. There are, however, a number of compounds distributed widely through the plant kingdom, including beans, greens, and berries, that appear to have the same effect naturally. For example, dripping green tea on colon, esophageal, or prostate cancer cells has been shown to reactivate genes silenced by the cancer. This hasn't just been demonstrated in a petri dish, though. 3 hours after eating a cup of broccoli sprouts, the enzyme that cancers use to help silence our defenses is suppressed in your bloodstream to an extent equal to or greater than the chemotherapy agent specifically designed for that purpose without the toxic side effects. What if we ate a diet chock full of plant foods? In the Gene Expression Modulation by Intervention with Nutrition and Lifestyle study, called the GEMINAL study, Dr. Ornish and colleagues took biopsies from men with prostate cancer before and after 3 months of intensive lifestyle changes that included a whole food plant-based diet. Without any chemotherapy or radiation, beneficial changes in gene expression for 500 different genes were noted. Within just a few months, the expression of disease-preventing genes was boosted, and oncogenes that promote breast and prostate cancer were suppressed. Whatever genes we may have inherited from our parents, what we eat can affect how those genes affect our health. The power is mainly in our hands and on our plates. This audiobook is divided into two parts, the why and the how. In part one, the why to eat healthfully section, I'll explore the role diet can play in the prevention, treatment, and reversal of the 15 leading causes of death in the United States, as I listed. I'll then take a closer look at more practical aspects of healthy eating in the how to eat healthfully section presented in part two. For example, we'll see in part one why beans and greens are among the healthiest foods on earth. Then, in part two, we'll look at how best to eat them. We'll explore such issues as how many greens to eat every day and whether they're best cooked, canned, fresh, or frozen. We'll see in part one why it's important to eat at least 9 servings of fruits and vegetables daily, and then in part two, we'll help you decide whether to buy organic or conventional produce. I'll try to answer all the common questions I receive daily and then offer real-world tips for grocery shopping and meal planning to make it as easy as possible to best feed yourself and your family. Besides writing more books, I intend to keep lecturing at medical schools and speaking at hospitals and conferences for as long as I can. I'm going to keep trying to ignite the spark that led my colleagues into the healing profession in the first place, to help people get better. There are tools missing from too many doctors' medical toolboxes, powerful interventions that can make many of our patients well again instead of merely slowing their decline. I'll keep working on trying to change the system, but you, the listener, don't have to wait. You can start now by following the recommendations within the following chapters. Eating healthier is easier than you think. It's inexpensive and might just save your life.